Accession number 29065, Mr. Michael White, Reel 14. Now, another effect of this decreasing number of personnel seems to be that you have to do more guard duties, which as a Tara you hadn't really had to do before. But
no, when it came to the early part of the when we first went to Korea, because we was more or less kind of like a full troop in numbers as such, and so like the signalers and the Taras did their kind of their what they call stags actually in the command post, and the gunners and the drivers did all the guard duties there. Now when we moved to different positions, we had different different emplacements, for want of better words, and so that as we moved to others, we had different holes on different ridges, and so the actual guard was dropped off in these different holes, and then also they used to have what they call these mobile guards, where they'd perhaps be, because there were a lot of people behind, there were a lot of guerrillas behind, and they kind of some of these, especially these what do you call the Red Cross or the first aid trucks, there someone were being blown up or kind of fired upon and things like that, and so we had to have we used to have people kind of what we call patrolling within our kind of mortar area. So we used to have one person either one person or two persons going in front, say with rifles, and then behind them was someone perhaps with a Sten gun in case they like the first ones were kind of ambushed as such. And so this were, and of course as we got less in numbers, and of course people were getting so tired with all the firing and diggings and things like that, because no one was allowed to sleep in the daytime, and of course during the night time you may be kind of spending, you know, quite a number of periods, you know, firing guns and being that. So the guards, so they decided in the end to make everyone who was not under the rank of sergeant went on guards, and this included Taras when they were not kind of being used, and signalers and things like that. And so that as we moved to, especially I remember the rear position, or the last position we went to, I think we were supporting the Royal Leicesters at that time. And this is when we had the problem with, you know, with tiredness, when I was on one party being dropped off when we was on guard, and we got to one of these holes in the ground sort of thing, and of course we used to have passwords, and of course when we called out kind of the password, there was no kind of reply from that, and of course the fellow on guard, he was asleep, he'd fallen asleep, which was quite understandable really. And of course in a warlike situation like in the front line in Korea, this was quite a serious problem, and so the sergeant who was in charge of the guard, he brought him to the attention of the troop commander sort of thing, and this fellow was court-martialed, and the fellow was actually court-martialed, he was not just a lowly gunner, he was a lance bombardier. And so so then the problem then, they then had a field court martial, and I was part of it.
And what happened?
Well, I think it was either the colonel of the regiment, the 6th First Light Regiment, or whether he was from the battery commander. And I always remember they had this table. It was all in the open air. This was in kind of more the summery period and things like that. And I think there was about three officers behind this table. And then each individual had to go up to this thing, and then it was questioned, this, that, and the other sort of thing, and things like that. And of course, we all knew the actual problem was, and of course, everyone actually denied, because it was dark, that we didn't see, we could not see whether he was asleep or whether he was not, sort of thing. So in the end, it was only the sergeant, the guard commander as such, he was the one who was actually bringing the charge against him, plus the troop commander. And so what actually happened in the end, that kind of say the I was then told, because I was actually coming towards the end of my period actually in Korea, my national service coming to an end, and I was told I would then have to stay in Korea because of this court martial, you know, which would be that. And but eventually that I was then called back to the battery headquarters, and I remember I had to swear on a Bible as such, that kind of blah blah blah, and I still stuck to my original statement that I could not see that he was actually asleep, although everyone actually knew that he was asleep. But anyway, his case came up sort of thing, and he was then given 9 months field detention. Now, I was actually coming...
Now, we'll come back to that, because you've run on a bit there. That's Sorry. When you finish it. It's no problem there. Now, what was it like being on guard duty? Because you hadn't done it really before. Yeah.
Now, being on guard, especially when, because it would start coming the spring, the summer period and things like that, and you used to be kind of dropped off into these holes. And, of course, you've got all this, barbed wire and things like that. And of course, at night time, it became very, very eerie. And, of course, when you're kind of by yourself actually in the guard, it was a tremendous job trying to keep yourself awake. And I remember, because being in the print, I was on some very complicated machinery in the print and things like that. And I used to try to keep myself awake. I tried to remember all the names of the parts of this machine to keep going. But also during the night time, in fact, you used to get the cracks, you know, kind of the undergrowth used to rustle. You used to get these cracks because there was quite a lot of wildlife about, especially rats and things like that. And also as well that I remember on more than one occasion when you get this crack in front of, because there's no one around you, that to kind of with a rifle, you could actually pull the trigger to its first position before, and then you pulled the second part before it actually fired. And I remember doing that quite often. But there was another thing when it became more the summery period, because there was lots of paddy fields and water, and especially when it rained and things like that, there used to be these bullfrogs, seemed to say, like when I was in Hong Kong, and kind of these bullfrogs all through kind of like the night period and things like that, they used to croak away, and it kind of a crack, crack, crack all the time and things like that. Then all of a sudden these bullfrogs would actually stop croaking when anyone was about, and this is kind of when it became very, very jumpy and that.
So you were quite nervous.
Of course, but you see, this also, I remember this position as well, sort of thing, when we first moved there, because we were digging, and of course we were firing at the same time, and of course all the so-called command posts and the artillery board was all out in the open, the radios and things like that, and the wirelesses, and all around us there were lots of these Chinese stick grenades, you know, these are like the German stick grenades where you've kind of got, they used to have a long, like a bamboo handle with this big lumpy firing piece at the end, and inside the hollow of the bamboo thing there used to be like a ring where they used to pull it. And of course I suppose lots of these grenades either misfired or they didn't fire, but you see people were very reluctant to touch them because they didn't know where they were booby trapped and things like that. And it reminds me of kind of like in our previous position round on the barbed wire there, we used to have all these cans rattling away. But also there was a Chinese burp gun in this thing, I suppose, in a previous thing, perhaps before we arrived, I suppose, when the position was attacked and that. But you see, that burp gun stayed there all the time we were there because people were reluctant to touch it because they didn't know where they were booby-trapped because there were problems with the mines and things like that.
Now, there's a restriction on mortar firing. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, there was a period when we had orders from the rear to say we were not to fire on any target unless there were at least five persons there. And so the of course it seems so strange, really, kind of going in a warlike situation that kind of you were going to war with more or less your hands tied behind your back, sort of thing, you know, not be able to fire and things like that. But I think one of the main reasons were they were kind of trying to stockpile ammunition for this expected, perhaps this new spring offensive, which they're expecting the Chinese to, a newer spring offensive, seemed to when all the Gloucesters all had all their problems and that.
So there wasn't really enough ammunition, really.
Well, all this ammunition used to come from, I think they were picking up from anywhere, from Singapore. I think it went back to Singapore, from Hong Kong and things like that. And on lots of these boxes, you'd see this kind of Singapore or Hong Kong. And also this date was on it, kind of the old World War II ammunition. And so so this is where we used to get the problems with all kind of the fins falling off the bombs.
Now, the next thing that in your notes is you've got... R&R local leave in Japan. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. So similar to the leave situation into the leave camp at Incheon, where you should go for 5 days, I think in the end of 1950s, this was the Americans, really. They brought in this R&R leave to Japan. And so that the Brits used to kind of go away in dribbles and drabbles, you know, in ones and twos and things like that. And I think it was in May, I always remember it was May 1952 when I went to Japan, because I think I just about had another birthday. Anyway, so from there we went by truck from our positions, because you didn't know really where you were going. You got no idea at all. We went down to Kimpo Airfield, which was kind of like on the outskirts of Seoul itself. And the airfield itself at that time, as I remember it, instead of having what I call like a runway as such, they used to have all these metal things down on the floor, on the grass as such. And most of the planes there were all these old transport planes like Dakotas and I suppose Skymasters and things like that. I mean, they were all American planes. And so I remember kind of when we got down there, it was mostly wooden sheds, as I remember, and we had to wait a long, long time, and then eventually we actually boarded this four-engine, I think it was like a Skymaster, and when we boarded it, there was all the seating was all this webbing seating down the sides of the fuselage, and then in the centre of the plane itself, there were all these big wooden boxes and things like that, and all the people boarding it, they're all sorts, they were kind of like Brits, Canadians, Australians and things like that. And then we flew to Tokyo in Japan, and I think it took about 4 hours to get there. And but I do remember the plane was very, very noisy, you know, kind of the old propeller driven. And anyway, we had this marvellous view as we flew over kind of Mount Fujiyama, Mount Fuji sort of thing, with its snow topped the volcano and that. And it was a beautiful sight. And then we kind of landed somewhere in Tokyo. We got no idea. And then we went to a place, a leave camp, which was called the Ibisu Hotel.
And what was the condition like there? What was the hotel like?
When we actually got there, the first thing they do, we went for a shower, and they removed all, they gave us all new underclothes and things like that. And then, of course, they used to have the Japanese girls, and they had proper beds there. And for the first time, as I remember, being in the army, because I was coming towards the end of my period of national service, and they had white sheets, and we'd never seen white sheets before and things like that. And I remember kind of, because with the tiring, you know, kind of the drudgery of the front line in Korea, you know, not getting much sleep and what have you, I remember we all went to bed sort of thing, and I remember I didn't wake up till I think the following afternoon. We you know, we're tired out, and of course the food was I suppose it was quite tremendous for what I remember. But we was there more or less for 5 days, and then kind of you could come and go as you so wished. Now there used to be I think there was some of the WVS ladies there, and they used to arrange some of these trips to some of the so-called beauty spots in Japan or locally to Tokyo. And I know one of the trips was to Hiroshima, is whether it's called, you know, where the atomic bomb of World War II had been dropped and things like that. And but you see, most of the lads, they're all from the drab front line of Korea. And the last thing they wanted to see any further devastation and things like that, all they really wanted to see was the bright lights of Tokyo and that. And so I remember that the first night sort of thing, there were about four or five of us lads sort of thing, we jumped into, because there were lots of these Japanese taxis about, we jumped into these taxis, and we all finished up in some hotel, and of course they wouldn't let us come in, because our mode of dress was the army uniform and big boots and things like that, so we had to remove our boots. And there was all these Japanese slippers there and things like that. And and then afterwards we went out to see the bright lights in the Ginza area. We was amazed, really, because we always thought Tokyo had been smashed down and burnt to the cinder, you know, by the American bombers during World War II. But it was amazing, really, the number of quite tall buildings and, you know, big what are called superstores and things like that, where it was all these beautiful goods which were non-existent, as I remember, before I left the UK.
And what were you doing? Were you drinking or eating, or, you know?
Well, I mean, they were different. There were different things, different modes, what people wanted. I mean, there was always plenty of food, actually, in the camp and things like that. Some of the lads, they went out. Because we were only mostly young national servicemen, most of the regular sort of thing, and they went out on the, you know, the bars and the big booze ups and things like that. Some of them went for the women, you know, the prostitutes and what have you. And then it was... I remember also as well seeing the palace, Emperor Hirohito's palace sort of thing, and I remember having a wander around the walls and things like that. And I remember on one occasion, how it happened, I was got on this train to get back to Ibisu Hotel. So when I say hotel, this is what it was called. It was a leave camp, and I got on the station, and of course all the characters actually on the station, they're all in Japanese characters, and there was nothing in kind of English as such. And kind of when I got on the train sort of thing, I got no idea where I was actually going. And eventually I asked one or two kind of Japanese, and of course they couldn't speak English. And then there was a young lad, he was like a student, and of course in those days the Japanese students, they used to dress in kind of like a dark porter type uniform, and I think he had a little hat on, but he understood English. And so when I was on, of course it was an electric train as I remember it, and as we kind of got nearer to Ibisu sort of thing, and there was us, it was in English letters, Ibisu the station. And of course I was quite thankful really when I saw that, because being on that train, I could have finished up anywhere. And then after about 5 days as such of kind of living it up as such, and that we went back on the plane, and we went back to normal, back to our position again.
Now this is where you were starting to have people come in and go in, you know, and yeah. But it's also when one of your friends was wounded. Can you tell us that story?
Yes, kind of in the more spring to summery period and things like that, and we'd moved beyond the Royal Leicesters, and there was two different types of fire. We used to fire kind of when they used to give the orders to the guns, kind of HE-162 five rounds gun fire and things like that, and the guns used to fire singly and things like that. But when they wanted to kind of catch the Chinese on the hop sort of thing, you know, kind of like one of these bunkers where they was moving about, they used to have what they called a salvo. So they used to kind of give the all the guns, and when all the guns were ready, they used to put the bomb in the top sort of thing. It was still in the barrel. And when they used to yell out fire, they used to thump it down with the hand, and it used to go down to the barrel, and it used to fire. And so all four guns fired at the same time. So instead of one round landed, forward land and things like that. And of course there was all this banging and crashing going on, and of course there were incoming rounds as well. And I remember there was one big bang sort of thing, and someone yelled out kind of my friend, his name was Les Rick, he said Rick's been hit sort of thing and things like that. And of course after everything had kind of happened, and you know, kind of the fire had ceased and things like that, I remember going over, because I was actually, when I first went to Korea, I had to sign for this big tin box full of first aid equipment and things like that. But this was the first really major thing within our actual troop where someone really got hit apart, the fellow who got killed. But when we went over to him and things like that, he got this huge great big hole in his upper right arm and things like that, and you could actually see the bone, this kind of white bone. And I was amazed really, there was no blood coming from, and everything was throbbing as I remember, and it was such a kind of big hole. And although kind of even from the period of joining the forces, you was issued with one of these first aid things where you had a special pocket in your battle dress, and you was told on no uncertain terms you were not allowed to use that, because people would be using it to clean their boots and things like that. So all that period there, we had that first aid dressing, and no one really seemed to know to handle it, because up to that period we'd always use the infantry's first aid thing, you know, kind of if you got any problems, you know, sicknesses and any injuries and frostbites and things like that. And so eventually someone actually got this first aid dressings and some of these things out this tin box, and they wrapped it around his arm, and then he was then transported to the infantry's first aid post. And then I think he went by helicopter, I think, and jeep, and then he went to some form of a MASH, I'm not sure it was in the Norwegian MASH, and then eventually he then went by, I can't think whether he went by plane or whether he went by boat, he went to Kure in Japan, and there he was in the Kure hospital, and there they actually said that I think his arm was broken. And so he actually stayed there for the rest of the time. But whilst he was there, he actually wrote to me, because in Tokyo there was all these in these PX stores and the Naffies and things like that, there was all these goods and like tea sets and things like that. So I actually sent him 25 shillings, this is the old money, to him, and he purchased from the PX or the Naffy, he purchased this tea set, which was the delicate Japanese tea set with the teapot and all the cups and saucers and what have you. And when you used to hold the tea cup to the light, you could see the image of a geisha girl in the bottom. Anyway, he sent this to my home in England and things like that. But he never actually returned to the mortar troop. And of course, when he actually went back onto the troop ship going home, he travelled most of the journey actually in the hospital part of the ship. And I think they actually re-broke his arm again to things like that. And it was only later on when I was in the TA, I actually met him briefly for a short brief part.
Now, the Americans started to put searchlights into your area. Now, what were these for?
Well, I think the searchlights, this was a period in, I suppose, about 1952. They were starting these peace talks and things like that at Panmunjom and, was it, Kaesong and things like that. And really, that was slightly over to our left, where and I think the Americans, I think there was some sort of agreement that they would have these searchlights on some hills to the back, and they would shine theoretically onto near Panmunjom and Kaesong, which we were quite close to really. And so that any,
it's onto the Chinese position.
Yeah, this was over on the Chinese side, the other side, and so that where they're going to have these peace talks, so that our guns as such would not be firing on them, and so that none of the airstrikes would actually drop any napalms and bombs and things like that, rockets onto them. So what would happen at night time, this was more in the summery period as I remember, and at night time these searchlights used to shine right across these kind of hills, and it used to kind of quite often used to come over where we were and to shine onto the Chinese hills as well. But we were quite concerned really, because the Chinese could actually, you know, pinpoint us really, because it used to light up our positions and things like that. And we used to wonder really at that time, because we got no idea about the peace talks, we wondered really why the Chinese artillery did not kind of destroy them as such. But we, you know, we thought, well, perhaps it was better for them than it was for us, things like that.
Now, one thing I know that upset you was pay. Can you tell us about that? Because you were upset about the differential between regulars and national service pay. There's quite a chunk in your memoir about this. Tell us, just explain what upset you.
Well, as a national serviceman, when we actually joined up, we only got about 25 shillings and such, and most of the young lads, they used to send 7 shillings home to their parents, you know, kind of like, you know, to help out sort of thing. And so when we actually eventually went to Korea, the national servicemen for the first year, right up to the last 6 months, we got purely the national servicemen's pay, which was only a pitiful amount, although we couldn't really spend much anyway. But the regulars, they got more or less twice as much as we did, because they'd signed on for about 5 years. And that, and of course, at the same time, you've got the Americans who their pay differential was tremendous, really, compared with the British soldier. And also the same with the Australians. They got, perhaps twice, maybe three times as much as the British soldier. And of course, the national servicemen, I mean, they always considered themselves a little bit more intelligent than some of the regulars, because back home in England, the work, anyone could get a job anywhere as such. So really, they used to think about the regulars, you know, they were kind of like a less intelligent, and the national servicemen were mostly kind of in the artillery troop of ours, were mostly signallers or tarers and things like that, and the regulars were mostly the drivers or the gunners. And so they used to be quite a little bit upset at that. But when it came to the last 6 months, because the National Service had actually, because of the Korean War, they'd actually advanced it from, 18 months to 2 years because of the Korean War. And so when it came to the last 6 months, the National Serviceman's pay went up to the same as the regulars. And then I think at the same time, they updated the star system, because the pay was, especially with the regulars, it was all based on the star system, about whether they could drive, whether they were passed the tests on the guns or the the educational tests they used to go, and all things like that. And so I think they updated me to, I think it was 4 stars, as I remember, you know, because I was driving, and then I was a tar and other bits and pieces, and because of signals and that. And so my pay differential went up. It was only a few shillings, but it was a little bit more and things like that. And then also on top of that, they decided, because finally kind of the Korean troops as such had perhaps deserved something, and perhaps a concern from afar, they decided to give, they gave you £10 extra bonus for being in Korea for the first 3 months, and I think every month onward that it was worth £1, so you got £10 and then £1 extra. But the National Service are always peeved about kind of their pay differential, because they consider themselves as good and things like that. And of course the National Servicemen, they were getting killed, they were getting wounded, and they were getting taken prisoner and things like that.
Now, anything else before we come to the end of your time? I mean, were you looking forward to being demobilised? Sent back from Korea and demobilised? You know, you start in, as the summer approaches, you're getting near the end.
Well, I've heard these tales about national servicemen in England, where they used to have these charts on the wall where they used to tick off the days because they hated it so much. But in Korea, every day was a full day of 24 hours and things like that. And so really, you was constantly on the go, on the move and things like that. And you never really had a lot of time to consider about kind of when your time was coming to an end. And of course, I actually joined, I can still remember the exact date, it was August the 24th, 1950. So my period of ending as such should have been August the 24th, 1952. And so eventually, completely after I'd actually been to this this court-martial where I had to swear on the Bible.
Now, let's pick up that story then, because this is right at the end, isn't it, before you go. Now, what happened? Because after the court-martial, you were given the job of taking him back. Tell us about that.
Yes, after this person, he was a Lance Bombardier, and he was given 9 months field detention. Now, to me, being a national serviceman, I didn't know much about field detentions and things like that. And because my period was coming to an end in Korea sort of thing, and we'd had these new replacements, and I remember there was a new Tara came from somewhere. I never really got to know him much, really. I had to put him in, tell him how things worked and things like that, and about the artillery board and the direct and what have you. But because my period was coming to an end, they decided that I should kind of accompany or escort this Lance Bombardier back to this field detention camp somewhere beyond the line. I don't know where it was, somewhere, I suppose, near Seoul, I don't know. So we went in the back of a 1500 weight. I mean, he'd still got he got all his kit with him, because he was going. He got a Sten gun, he had. And, of course, at that time, I'd only got a rifle. And, of course, we was going down. And, I mean, he could easily escape and things like that. But, I mean, where it had happened in Korea, I just do not know. But as we got further down, we eventually come to this so-called field detention camp. And I remember I was horrified when I first saw it, because there was this huge, great big barbed wire fencing and things like that, and it reminded me like when you see pictures of the concentration camps. And I remember we came to this entrance, and there were these huge, great big military police, Canadians they were. And anyway, because this poor fellow, he was only a small chap as well, this Lance Bombardier. Anyway, so we had got out sort of thing, and I had to kind of report to the reception, and I had to sign the necessary documentation and hand over the kind of the paperwork. And then they took off his Sten gun and his kit bag and things like that. And there was some form of like one of these assault courses in this thing, kind of, and they had him crawling under this barbed wire and things like that. And I was pleased to get away from there, things like that. So really, that was my first experience of field detention. But I do understand there was quite a few people actually went in field detention.
Now, you went back from there to rejoin your unit.
I then went back to the mortar troop, because I was still I was still kind of part of it. I was still the time, you know, I was still the chief tire as such.
Now, but in July, this was not long before, it may have even been, left in July. Now, what about the leaving? What sort of leaving did you have when you left the troop? What was that?
Well, when these actual orders came, you know, to go, because, I mean, over this period, there were different regulars going, because their period of 5 years was up, and I don't think we had any reservists in our lot, and because the odd national service, there weren't many national servicemen also, but it just kind of, the orders came from, I suppose, from battery headquarters to come in, that my name would be on it, and I was due to go report to battery headquarters and things like that, you know, because I was actually leaving. And of course, I do remember, because we were leaving, because the actual troop itself, from the whole Hong Kong days, it became quite a family orientated, even with the Korean porters. And of course, with a small, when you call it independent mortar troop, different to say the units behind the line where there was more discipline and that. You did not have to salute anyone under the rank of major. And of course, in a mortar troop like ours, the highest ranking person was a captain. And so really, as long as you said the odd sir to the officer, there was no saluting. And of course, with the only person you'd actually be careful with was the sergeant major, things like that. But all the sergeants and bombardiers and all things like that, it was usually kind of called him either Sarge or Bum or Fred or whatever his name was. And of course, my name really kind of with the surname of White, all Whites are Chalkies. And so I was always known as Chalky. And of course, we had two Chalkies in our troop. Both of us, amazingly, were Taras. And he was Chalky 197 and I was Chalky 248 or whatever the last three numbers of our number was. And so this was it. And so when it came to the point of actually leaving, because everyone kind of lived in each other's pockets, so